Hi, and welcome to SPED Homeschool Conversations. My name is Peggy Ployer, and we are so excited to have you here on this broadcast that's supported by SPED Homeschool. And my special guest tonight is Dr. Anne Maria DeMars. Welcome, hey. Doctor.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited. We've been chatting for over half an hour, so we're just going to continue our conversation now with you all involved. So tonight we're going to be talking about preteen math and how to survive it without tears, both yours and your child's. I think that is probably something that a lot of people are going to be tuning in on either live right now or watching later on either our YouTube channel or on this recorded session on either our podcast or on Facebook. And so I just thank you for being willing to share some of your expertise in this area. Yeah. And I thought maybe you could introduce yourself and let our audience know a little bit about your background and some of the reasons that you homeschooled too, some of your kids, and just give us an idea of what you're doing also for the educational community as well. You have some very exciting projects that you're working on with some educational software that I want our audience to know about as well.
Right. Well, I have four kids, and I have also a PhD in educational psychology, and my specializations were applied statistics and psychometrics, so test and measurement. And before I went and got a doctorate, I had an MBA, and I was an industrial engineer working on designing missiles and airplanes, the airspace industry. Wow. But how I really got interested in special education, I went back to school and I was teaching middle school, eighth graders who were severely emotionally disturbed, and a lot of them had real attentional learning problems as well. And what I realized is, okay, we've got these psychologists over here that are working on their behavior issues, don't punch other kids in the face or whatever. Exactly. But we don't have people who are working on their academic skills. And a lot of these kids, they had two problems. One is that they were very behind academically because they had spent a good bit of time in juvenile hall or on the run or with other problems. And then the other thing was they often had real issues with authority, that many of these, 30% of the kids in our school were adopted. So this idea of, oh, it's because they have terrible parents. No, sometimes they had wonderful parents who were just doing way better than I could have under the circumstances. But the student's very defiant. They don't want to do anything. And I thought, if I could make something on the computer that kind of remove that authority figure they're rebelling against and taught them math, then while the people over here fix their other issues, when they graduate from high school, they have some shot of going to college, getting a job. Because this is one of the things that puzzles me all the time, and I have a lot of conversations with people about this. How is it that kids just don't see that if they go to class, they don't do any work, they graduate from high school, they're at the fourth grade level and everything, how do they think they're going to get a job and survive and be successful, but they don't really think about it? So anyway,
they just think about getting through school, and what's after that? You know, our society lies to them and says, you know, as long as you graduate from high school, you'll succeed. Or if you can, you know, then get into college, you'll succeed. Well, that isn't really the truth.
Well, I was just talking to someone today who used to be president of a tribal college. And I said, you know, what is it with these kids? How do they not? How is it that when I go into middle school classrooms sometimes and I will see the teachers who are good teachers collecting the assignments, and 20% of them, 30% of them, they're blank. They can put their name on it and did nothing. And he said, well, they just don't see that it's going to be related to anything they're going to do in life, which to me is astounding, but it didn't occur to me initially. That's something we really have to directly teach, that you will use math in the future. In fact, we've got videos that say that you're going to need math in the future.
Right. Yeah. And making it applicable. And, but I think, you know, like we were talking about earlier, before we started recording, was that even parents don't always know how to relate that to their children, mm-hmm. and say how it's applicable. They've been afraid of math as well. And, it just seems to be this thing that is separate from the rest of life, because we think of math as, you know, equations.
Right. Well, that's funny to me, because I think of math as just so integral to life. And one of the aha moments when we started Seven Generation Games, which is what I'm doing now, I was on the Spirit Lake Nation and I was walking through the middle school with my friend who was at the time president of the school board, and one of his grandchildren came up to him, and his grandson must have done poorly on a math test that day. And he says to him, "Papa, I don't need to do math because I'm an Indian." Mm-hmm. And Eric stops dead in his tracks and he looks down at him. He says, "My boy, the Dakota were nomadic people. We roamed all over the Great Plains. Do you think when we met up with another tribe to trade, it was just, wow, what a surprise meeting you here?" He said, "No, we estimated how long it would take to get from one point to the next. Mm-hmm. You know, we estimated how much food it would take. You know, you didn't see dead Indians lying all over the plains." And you know why? Because they had some idea of how much food they needed to carry, how much they needed to, you know, hunt for the winter. And I just thought that would be an amazing game.
Yes.
So Eric and I, my same friend, we were in Washington, D.C. We got invited to analyze the National Indian Education Study, which is data on all of... We got asked to analyze the data on all of the American Indian, Alaska Native children in the U.S. And so one of the things that we found was that the more they learned their culture in school, the worse they did in math, which surprised me. And my friend, who, like I said, was on the president of the school board on this reservation, was not surprised at all. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Look at it. You know," he said, "you're into math. Look at it this way. There's so many hours in a school day. If I take an hour out of every day and we learn Dakota language and Dakota culture, that's an hour less for math and reading and everything else." So we're coming back from the airport, and we're going back to the airport to fly home to our respective states. And he turns to me and he says, "I'm not accepting this. I'm not going to accept that my grandkids will learn their culture. They'll learn math. I want you, you know, you should do something about it." Now, how it became my responsibility, I've yet to figure out. But I thought, well, I had wanted to do these math games ever since I was in graduate school. So I came up with this idea. We went to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said, "The math scores on the reservations are really low. Software, a lot of times, is not being made with these rural areas in mind. It's assuming that you have high-speed internet, which a lot of people don't, that you have reliable internet that a lot of people don't." So yeah, they funded us, and every game needs a story, right? A good story. Mm-hmm. So our first games, the storyline was on Native American history. And so we did a controlled study. We found the kids who played our games improved their math scores 3 times as much as the ones who didn't. And so then we did a Kickstarter campaign to try and raise money after the grant funds were out. And we thought we were going to be this little company, this little niche company that was working on the reservation, selling to people who are worried about Native American kids doing poorly in math. And then we have people contacting us saying, "Well, I homeschool my kids, and I don't feel like math is my strongest subject. Are these games only for Native Americans?" And Maria, who's our CEO, said, "You got $10 because they're for you." She said, "You know, I played Super Mario Brothers when I was a kid, and I was never a plumber in overalls. You know, I love the movie Braveheart, and lots of people who are not Scottish do." And she said, "If a good story is a good story, and good educational design is good design." So, so yeah, we started out on the Spirit Lake Nation, and then we went to the Total Mountain Reservation, and we are now in all over the U.S., in Trinidad, in Chile. It's been a good run.
Yeah, and that's, I think, how I found you. I was just looking on the internet and ran across your game and thought, this is neat. And So yeah, it's something that I think a lot of homeschoolers do is they do what's called a unit study. So they incorporate lots of different types of subjects in one type of study. And so it has that crossover. And like you said, it makes it more applicable to everyday life because all of a sudden you see how one subject can affect another instead of compartmentalizing them like a school usually would.
Yeah. Well, and it's crazy to me when I hear people say, when would I ever use this? Or I don't use math, because you use it every day, whether you realize or not. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that often I think this is why what we do is so important. When parents are teaching their kids, they very seldom have a problem with teaching them to add or subtract or mm-hmm. to learn their multiplication tables. But whether it's a parent teaching or, you know, someone in the public schools, once they start getting into things like fractions or decimals or multi-step word problems, that's where people start to run into trouble. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate thing about that is that's the math that matters, because I don't know about you, but in my life, no one ever sprints into my office and says, quick, what's 11 times 8? And then I have 5 seconds to answer, and then they run back out again. You know, that's not what happens.
Exactly. We're trying to figure out how to multiply a recipe times 3. So you've got like a cup and 3/4 times 3. What in the heck is that?
Exactly. Or you're driving and you think, okay, I get about, you know, I've got a hybrid. I get about 50 miles to the gallon and it's 150 mm-hmm. miles to this place. I'm really in a hurry, but do I have enough gas to make it?
Enough gas. Exactly.
Those are the kind of things we do every day. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people are scared away from those. And one of the things that I've seen is that if you're not good at math, it cuts your options. You know, so I was explaining to someone, they said, well, why do you do what you do? You know, you and your co-founders, you both had really good paying jobs and you quit. And, you know, the first 2 years, we didn't pay ourselves at all with this company, because that's what you do when you're starting.
Exactly.
And, you know, now we get paid, but, you know, we'd all make a lot more money if we quit and went back to what we used to do. Mm-hmm. But it's that I've seen so many people that their life was less than it could be, because they got scared away because of math.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk about math anxiety. Nobody has math anxiety. Nobody has, you know, nightmares about being chased down the hall by algebra test wielding sharp pencils.
Exactly.
It's that they are afraid they won't be able to do it. They're afraid of feeling stupid. Mm-hmm. They're afraid of failing. And that, so that's kind of why when we did the games, we looked at what do people who are good teachers do. And one of the things they do is they break things down into manageable steps. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that drives me crazy is when people say, I don't have a math brain. You know, there's no such thing. Often what it is they don't have those foundational skills. Mm-hmm. It's like on your street, you built a bunch of houses and you didn't build a foundation and all the houses fell over, it wouldn't make sense to say, oh, we don't have a street that's made for houses. No, you just didn't have a foundation. And if you had gone back and dug the foundation and done it right, they would have been able to do it. And one of the things that we say all the time is that just because a child hasn't learned it yet, or an adult, doesn't mean they can't learn it. So the nice thing about games is you don't have to feel stupid. You know, you're playing a game mm-hmm. and everybody, like, did you ever play the game Tetris? You know, the game where you turn the things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tetris mm-hmm. is one of the most successful games ever made. Did you know there's no way to win Tetris? It just gets harder and harder and harder, and then you fail.
Right.
And if you said to somebody, this is how we're going to design education, they would think you had lost your mind.
Oh, yeah.
But the reason that people play Tetris is there's no negative side. Okay, you're learning. Mm-hmm. Okay, even if at some point, you know, you fail at it, but then the next time you get further, and the next time you get further. And so when we made our games, we looked both at what's good education, what's good games. Mm-hmm. And the problem with a lot of games is they're either designed by people who are software developers, and they're good at making games, but you look at them, where's the education part? And there's a lot of just complete BS in education. I'm sorry, but you've probably seen a lot of snake web sales in your life, right?
Yes, I have.
You know, I drive a car, but that doesn't make me a mechanical engineer. And there's a lot of people, oh, when they're doing this fractal program, they're learning physics. No, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they made this house out of popsicle sticks, and so now they learned engineering. Well, maybe at a very, very rudimentary level.
Right.
But what we try, so you have the people who are making these fun games, but the educational component of it is very, very questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people.
Very small. There's no projected outlook as to where the goal you're trying to reach and how the pieces that you're working on are going to fit together to meet that end goal. It's just a bunch of stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and when I hear those buzzwords, anyone in business, you hear that, oh, I facilitate teamwork. What do you actually do, you know? Or, oh, we develop brain neuroplasticity. Well, I don't know about you, but our game Fish Lake teaches you how to add and subtract fractions and what's a fraction and multiply. You know, our game Forgotten Trail teaches you what's a median, what's a mean, what's a distribution. But it does it in an interesting way. Like there's a part in Forgotten Trail where they're telling a story about how the Ojibwe got the dog, which is, a really interesting story. And in there, the aunt's telling the story and how they ran into a giant. And then the kid said, well, was it really a giant?
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, well, let's look at this. My grandma had this many grandkids, and this many of them were 5 foot tall, and this many six, and this many seven. And the giant was 20 feet tall. And so then there's a little graph that comes up, and you drag the graph, and it shows you, wow, that was really at the far end of the distribution. So, I mean, yeah, it's a game. And then you go back, and there's part where you jump over the giant footsteps in the game and try not to fall into the water. But in there, there's direct teaching. And this idea that we have to discover everything. It's okay to discover some things, but it's also okay to sometimes tell people stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look things up on Google and it doesn't say, you know, you don't type stuff into Google and it doesn't come up with a message, well, wouldn't you rather discover this theorem yourself? No, it's okay to look stuff up.
Right. There's certain relative truths that aren't unchangeable. And we live in a very relative society that says, well, you know, however you want to make it look, it's okay. But we can't make education that way, especially on the foundational things.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's basically what you're saying. And I totally agree, because once you mess up that foundation, everything you build on top of that is not going to be.
Exactly.
It's not going to work. Yeah. So we have some viewers, and I have one comment already that Melissa had said, yeah, real life applied mathematics, and she gave it a thumbs up. So definitely. So when the information that you sent me, we were going to talk about two things that you had kind of brought up, and that's the first one is that the issues with kids that they have when they approach math. The first one is just getting them to do it is an issue.
Right.
And then the second one is getting them to learn it. So, right. So let's talk about the, how do I get my child to actually do math?
Well, I know your focus is on kids with learning disabilities, so or special needs. So I want to talk about some of the problems that I have had.
Okay, yeah.
So, And I posted this on my blog, and this really was the sort of thing that drove me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to give an unrelated example, but it will illustrate it. So when one of my kids was 3 years old, she literally would climb on the table and swing from the chandelier. You know, when people talk about the kids swinging from the chandelier, no, this child literally did. And so I was telling this to a colleague of mine. I was at the University of California at the time, and she said, oh my gosh, your child is hyperactive, and I know somebody at the best clinic, and we'll get her in, and you know, I can pull some strings, and she can go and work with this famous professor and there address issues for hyperactivity. And I looked at her and I said, I moved the table. And this is the same thing. One of my kids, so she was being homeschooled, she was in middle school. And this, I would say, because I'm busy, right? And I'm working, and I would say, sit here and do, you know, we got 25 math problems to do. You're good at math. You're smart. Sit here and do this. And I look over, and 2 minutes later, no kid. Mm-hmm. And she's up in her room. What do you do? I couldn't find a pencil. So get her pencil, which, you know, cleverly was hidden like in the pencil box on the dresser. Go yeah. back downstairs, go back to what I was doing, look back 2 minutes later, no kid. You know, oh, I needed some scratch paper. And I went in your office to look for it, but then I couldn't find it. So then I was looking at these new paper clips that you got, the colorful. Mm-hmm. Get her back down to the table. You know, she's sitting there. I look back 2 minutes later, no kid. Mm-hmm. And I go back, and she's in her room playing some computer, some game on her Xbox. Because I, well, my pencil broke, and I went up to get a pencil sharpener, but I was looking for the pencil sharpener. Then I found this game I really wanted to play, and I started playing it. And, you know, and by now, 20 minutes have gone by. There have been two math problems done, and I'm just ready to wring her neck and throw her and the Xbox out the window. And, you know, the simplest thing that I found that, I mean, this applies to anybody, to any subject, but I got for each subject, mm-hmm. and for each subject, the key point for my kid, because otherwise, then she's going to quit doing her math and start reading the Anna Wurst book. For each mm-hmm. subject, I got a box. And in the box, I put everything she needed for that. And I set her and the box down at the table, uh-huh. and that cut down by, I would say, a good 50% the me screaming. Mm-hmm. Another thing, I told you that, you know, when we were chatting before, you can learn things from, you know, I don't want to be bashing on public schools or Catholic schools or whatever. I mean, there's some really good teachers. And one of them, when my daughter was in school and she, this teacher started to give instructions for, say, a spelling test, she would come up to her desk and the teacher with her pen just tap on my daughter's desk so she would look up and pay attention. Mm. And my daughter really, I mean, once you had her attention on something, she could often focus very well, but she was very easily, you know, until you caught that attention, it was like shiny things, catch my eye, you know?
Yeah.
So what I found to be really important is, okay, here's your stuff. Sit down here. And as much as for me, it was tempting because I'm working full time running a business while I'm homeschooling this kid to say, okay, you do this and I'm going to go in the office and, you know, work on this report. You just can't do that.
No, mm-mm. It's not on the focused, the very focused teaching that needs to happen. And yeah, it's, you just kind of have to say, can't do that right now.
Well, you know, maybe there comes a point where you can, but initially, no.
Yeah, and especially for preteens, definitely yes. not. They're not. Most of them don't have that self discipline. There's very few.
Okay, I'm going to turn the light on in here because it's getting dark.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have to tell our audience that that. I do this with my 14-year-old too, is I make sure that, because I'm busy working at home too. And when we do, we have things, especially that I know stresses her, and maybe I don't even need to be teaching her, but she's a auditory processor and she needs to talk to somebody or talk through it. And so just my being there will help her get through it. And I answer a question every once in a while. But if I was to get up and leave, then she just goes off and does whatever else that she's interested in. And about 2 hours later, I realized she's done nothing for the day so far. Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I came to the conclusion is I have stuff to do and I would just have to sit down at the table with her because every time she would, you know, start to get up and go, oh, mm-hmm. So stopping that, going to the room, looking for things. So, and plus it's being a good role model yourself.
Yes.
That I'm going to sit here and do this thing. You know, I often would have things like mail I had to go through. I usually had a stack of it or email I had to answer. So I'm sitting here doing this stuff I don't want to do. And maybe you're not really excited about doing your math. So that's one thing. You just absolutely have to accept the fact that if you have a child that has difficulty focusing, first of all, remove all possible distractions. Put everything in one spot. Don't put anything else there. And then you need to sit there so every time you can kind of remind them. And then the other thing is, you know, get rid of the should. Carl Rogers, who's a psychologist, in humanistic psychology, he used to talk about the tyranny of the should, that people think, oh, you have to do, oops, I close somebody's comment. That you should be able to do this by yourself at this age. But you know what? I don't know who says that, and maybe you should be able to, but if your child isn't, it is what it is.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. There's a comment from Amy, and she says that my son likes someone sitting with him while I work. Sometimes I can work on things but usually he has to have my undivided attention. I know her. I know Amy. And so I know her son is a lot younger, and usually at mm-hmm. a very young age, they do need your undivided attention. Right. You know, as we're getting, you know, we're mostly talking about preteens here. This is when you kind of start weaning them. But like you said, the should, you know, right. it's almost like a testing game. You know, you lean off a little bit and then you pull in and then you lean off. And I think that's what makes the preteen ages so difficult, is because sometimes they can act like a teenager and sometimes an adult, and then they can act like a 3-year-old. Right. And they go back and forth between that, and you just have to kind of gauge it every day.
Yeah, the best book title ever, it was from years ago. It was called "I Hate You and Get Out of My Life, But Can You Please Take Me and Cheryl to the Mall First?"
Oh. Yeah, they need you, but they don't want you. Oh, I remember that stage with my boys. And it's worse with boys, I think, because they want to be men. They don't need mom, but yet they really do need mom. So.
Well, and Amy there is saying about how she thinks small visual cues help. The other thing that I found helpful mm-hmm. is to do short bursts of time. You know, for work, there's what they call the Pomodoro technique. Pomodoro being Italian is for tomato. Huh. But he called it that because when the guy started doing it, he had some tomato timer that looked like a tomato. Who knows why he had that? But he did. And one of the things I found is that's really helpful is I say, all right, let's do it for 5 minutes or 2 minutes and turn it into a math problem. So let's say, all right, you sit here and I'm a big believer in assessment, not assessment mm-hmm. in the terms of let's do standardized assessments and sit down and have, you know, the SATs every week, but mm-hmm. let's look at how long it takes you to do a math problem. How long mm-hmm. can you actually focus? Mm-hmm. So if you can do 2 math problems, maybe your kid can only focus for 5 minutes. And again, that goes with the get away from the should. All right, well, they should be able to do long, or they can't. All right. Mm-hmm. So if they can focus for 3 minutes, for 5 minutes, you put up the timer and say, all right, you do these math problems for 5 minutes, and then you can go do what, you know, and give them a list, not whatever you want to do, because if I told my daughter whatever you want to do, she would be up in that room playing video games and I would have to pry it out of her hand. Mm-hmm. So I started, and it's funny because I don't know if you knew this, but I was the world judo champion. Total random act. And I also teach judo. Mm. And when I have kids come in, one of the things we often do, this sounds like it doesn't have to do with math, but it does, is circuits. So we'd say, all right, you're going to do a circuit. You do 5 push-ups, 5 sit-ups, 5 jumping jacks. Mm-hmm. And then you can do that again, and we'll do it for 30 seconds. And then we'll take a 15-second rest and do it again. And so they do that for, say, a minute when they start, and then gradually it gets to a minute and a half, and then 2 minutes, mm-hmm. and then 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So the kids can see their progress. So right. I might at first say, like, maybe if Amy's son is really young, say, all right, for 1 minute, can you do math for 1 minute without getting up or doing anything else? Okay, you could do it for 1 minute. Now you can have a 1 minute break. What are they going to do for that 1 minute? You could do a push up. You could do some sit ups. You could, go. So you want to have you want to give them limited things mm-hmm. so they're not, like I said, going upstairs and getting attached to their Xbox, or even, you know, some kids really like reading better than math, so they're going to start reading this book they're really into, mm-hmm. and then you have to pry it away from them. So you give them, all right, 30 seconds of this, and then let's get up and stretch, or mm-hmm. then it gradually gets to be a minute. All right, you're going to do your math problems for a minute, then let's, and one thing I'm a big fan of is casual games, which is, did you ever play like Candy Crush or, well, we had talked about Tetris, mm-hmm. Bejeweled, any of those kind of things?
Right.
I was very surprised when the most popular games we do are these games called Making Camp. There's Making Camp Bilingual, which is in Spanish and English, the Making Camp, Base Making Camp, which is free, teaches Math and Ojibwe, which is a Native American tribe. Oh, well, if you're from Minnesota, you know this. Okay, Ojibwe history. And then Meet and Camp Premium teaches language arts as well. And these are our most popular games. They are not the fanciest things we make. They're not the things with the most 3D. But what they are is something where a kid can play for a minute, 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. They can go in, they can do an activity where they're doing division problems and winning magnets and then go out of it. Mm-hmm. And casual games are actually played by hundreds of millions of people that you may not think of yourself as a gamer. So the reason I say those are a good choice for those 30-second breaks or those, 5-minute breaks is because they can play it for a little bit. And this is my sneaky thing of getting you to do what I want you to do by letting you do another thing I want you to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and like Amy said, getting her kids to be active. You know, I want my kids to be active. I want them to do those push-ups. I want them. Do this and then you can run around the house and I will let them do crazy things. You know, run around the house. You can run up and down the stairs and jump and do a little obstacles. Run up and down the stairs and jump up and down the couch. Oh my gosh, you know what we do? Maria has a question about how do you vary assessment when you're working with... How do you vary assessment when you're working with multiple kids across grade levels? Mm-hmm. One thing, and I'm gonna talk about our games here because I know them obviously the best, is I tell everybody start with the simplest, the easiest games. So like Spirit Lake teaches, if you have, we'll soon have it for iPad, but if you have Mac or Windows computers, it teaches multiplication division. Making Camp teaches multiplication division. So start them all at the same spot. And then the ones that it's easy for them, it's maybe below where they are, they will tell, oh, this is so easy. This is baby stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, my kid thinks math is easy. What a terrible parent I am, right? So, you know, and they'll zoom ahead, and the other ones that maybe that's at their level, it will take them longer and they'll spend time on. So, that's one way. We also, this is not, I mean, maybe I should be pushing things more, but this is not something homeschool parents use as much for the schools. They also use we have online tests that kids can take. Mm-hmm. And so you can look at that and see what they're getting right or wrong.
I have a blog coming out on Friday that is going to have a whole bunch of free assessments that you can find online. They'll have math assessments, reading, comprehensive, a whole bunch of things like that. So if you're looking for like a test type of assessment, but a lot of times parents won't teach math and reading to children in groups when they homeschool, just because they are at different levels. And those are basic skills that you want to make sure that you don't miss any spots with your child. Mm-hmm. So when you do group activities, like Dr. Ann Maria is talking about, that would be great. And especially if your children are competitive, you know, it may get the one that's kind of lagging behind. And even if maybe, especially if they're older, going, oh, they think this is easy. Maybe I should work on this a little harder. That's what Amy talked about, the competitive nature of her son. And that's one way to build on incentives. And then Maria also had a question, how do I engage my kids who are not interested in math? And I kind of wanted you to address for a little while incentives, because I know you had sent me some information about that too. How do we incentivize our education? We don't bribe them,
it depends on your point of view. I mean, people say, oh, you should learn it just for the love of it. I don't know. I personally got paid, when I do work, and I don't consider it a bribe. You know, all of our employees at Seven Generation Games, I'm sure they love us and they, you know, appreciate the work we do. But if I quit paying them, they'd probably quit showing up. So,
right.
I think it's fine to offer rewards, and like in our games, we try to do that. We're always looking for ideas to make things more interesting. Like when a kid, and it doesn't have to be, here's a dollar. Right. You know, when somebody wins at, you know, they level up, like Forgotten Trail, for example, or Aztec, there's just a, you know, little sound. And I remember my daughter saying, oh, I love that sound. You know, when she would be playing something, and it's just, a reinforcement. It can be Right. Good job.
That's a good word for it.
I'm proud of you. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I teach judo too, and I learned this from a friend of mine. He's a great coach. He said, you know, a gold medal can be a reinforcer, but so can good job. So can I'm proud of you. Mm-hmm. So can you have done great. Let's take an extra long break and, you know, do 15 sit-ups together. I don't know about you, but I could usually do a few more sit-ups myself, right? You know? Exactly. So, again, it's good for your kids. It's good for you. It's like Amy, I guess now we have two Amys on here, that had said, you know, her son wants her undivided attention. So, I think reinforcement is super important. And for a lot of kids, reinforcement has to occur very, very, very frequently. It doesn't have to be, you did a math problem, here's a cookie, but... Like in our games, we try to, after every problem, tell them if they got it right or wrong. And here's another thing too. You want to look at reinforcement, but you also want to remove punishment. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that people don't like math is they feel stupid. They got it wrong. They can't fool themselves that 1/8 equals, you know, 3/4, because it doesn't, and now they're wrong and they feel dumb. And Jane McGonigal, who wrote the book A Reality is Broken, about how she thinks games can fix the world, she said she looked at studies on games that people kept playing. Why do people keep playing games if they fail? And she says you need to learn to lose in interesting ways. So, for example, in Spirit Lake, the game, you're going out and your tribe, as there's an epidemic, you have to go out into the woods and find the right number of herbs and bring them back. And if you bring back the wrong number and there's too many, it shows everybody puking. Which it turns out that 10-year-olds are highly amused by people puking.
Oh, sure they are.
So even though you got the answer wrong and you have to go study, they have the same reaction you did. So it's not, oh, I'm stupid. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, I got the wrong answer. They threw over.
Too funny. Yeah, that's a very good point, is teaching kids how to fail too is really important, and how to move on from those failures. And if you do make them relatable, instead of saying, yes, this is wrong, and go back and do it. When I've learned that doing math with my kids, I've started doing all the problems with them until I knew that they knew how to do it. And then I gave them something to solve on their own, either two or three problems that I picked that I knew would kind of test what we just went through in maybe a different way, but mostly just to see if they could do it on their own without my help. But I would gauge how many questions we would do together before I even allowed them to do their individual ones. So I knew they were set up for success, and they could fail as much as they wanted to when we were doing them together. Mm-hmm. And that it was a kind of a safe place. That has worked really well as well. Yep. Amy Tripp said that, she goes, I love this topic. I see you have math games. My niece lives with me and loves video games, but how can I find good educational games? So what is your website is, Seven Generation Games.
SevenGenerationGames.com. So it's the number seven.
It's the number seven. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you can look at us. But I would say one thing that, you know, we were funded, like I was telling Peggy, we were originally funded by U.S. Department of Agriculture Small Business Innovation Research Grant. So we did a lot of research on what makes an effective game. And I'd say I would run from anything that doesn't really tell you what it teaches. If they say, oh, this is an educational game, it teaches brain plasticity or visual thinking skills or something like that. If I don't know how old your niece is. I'm assuming, since you're on here, that she's in that preteen group. If she's 10, 11, 12 years old, she needs to learn stuff like division, fractions, generally, multiplication. She doesn't have that down. Now they're getting into sixth grade, you know, basic statistics, how to compute an average. So the game should tell you specifically what they learn. So those games that have a lot of buzzwords, but no specifics on what they're teaching for math, I would steer away from those. Some people hate on Common Core standards. I think you need to not look at what the term is, but like in our case, there's a really good movie called Mask. I don't know if you've seen it, where Cher is in it. She's a mother, and her son has this facial deformity.
haven't watched it, but I know what one you're talking about.
Oh, I bet you'd like it. So she's at the school, and the principal is looking at her, and he's saying, well, I don't know if we have, you know, if we're available to meet his special needs here. And she looks at him, she says, do you teach algebra and English and biology at the school? Because those are his needs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whatever standard from your state or wherever you are, if you need, your child needs to learn to divide a three-digit number by a single-digit number, look and see if that's what it teaches. Does your child need to know how to do word problems? Look and see if that's what it teaches. So look and see if they say specifically what they teach. And then if you're playing game yourself, look and see, do you think it teaches that? You know, like
right.
Mm-hmm. A lot of games, in my experience, don't teach, they test. Now, that's not a bad thing, but if you're throwing math problems, right, it's a different thing. So is do you feel your child needs practice? Like, do they already know, they already know their multiplication tables, but they just need to practice them until they're automatic? Do they understand how to do word problems involving division, but they just need a little more practice? Right. Or do they not really get it? And I think a lot of games...
There's very few games that will provide instruction.
Well,
I think. Yes.
Look us up. But you're right. And McGonagall in her book, and a lot of people, I'm sorry to say, James G, I think is his last name, G-E-E, is another one that writes about gaming a lot. And he talks about shooting and games that are shooting and spelling, shooting and math. So it's like, here's a shooting thing, and here's the equation, 7 times 5, shoot the number that's the right answer. Mm-hmm. Or here's some synonyms, shoot the one that means the same word. Mm. And that doesn't teach you.
No.
So one thing we do a lot is we have games that, so like in Making Camp Premium, for example, we'll have something that explains what's a synonym. Mm-hmm. And they can watch that video, and then they can play the game where they pick out the synonyms, and they can play a game as many times as they want, or they can watch the movie again. So, yeah, I would say ask yourself, do they need instruction? Do they need practice? Do they need assessment? Mm-hmm. And fortunately, most educational games are just seeing if they know 7 times 5, seeing if they know 8 plus 2.
Right. The easier parts of math, which are the facts, not the processing parts of math, which are much more difficult. And I definitely want to make sure that we get into a little bit about how to break down that complicated, especially word problem, and how to teach your child to really learn math versus just that memorization part. That's, like you said, that's that hump that we sometimes hit and stop because that's when math changes. And it's not all of a sudden just being able to put up flashcards or a list of things. It's having to process everything you've learned plus all this new stuff.
Right. And, you know, you're talking about homeschooling. That's super important because it's funny, when my daughter started being homeschooled in the 5th grade, it was when a lot of the parents in our area anyway were giving up on homeschooling, to be honest. And it was easier for them to teach their younger kids. And math, for many of them, and the further along they got, the more of them dropped out. Math, for many of them, was a barrier. And it's because that's when, like you said, it gets a little more abstract and it gets a little more complex, and more so the more we go along. But I think there's a key to it that's not that hard. There's a book, it's kind of wonky, but it's called Questioning and Teaching by J.T. Dillon. Hmm. And in there he says that somebody can be said to have learned something when it answers the questions that they have. And that generally in classrooms, teachers pose questions and students answer them. But really, shouldn't it be the students that have the questions? I mean, they're the young ones. So for me, it's making those math problems things that your student is wondering about. Like, are we there yet?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which, I don't know if you've gone on trips, you've heard that 100 times. You know, are we there yet?
Yeah, we take a lot of road trips. Exactly.
Well,
we're teaching them the mile markers out the window. And
Well, that sign said we got 240 miles to go. We're going 40, 60 miles an hour. How long is it?
Mm-hmm.
So putting things in terms of things that matter to them. My granddaughter is very money motivated. She's very good at math. And so if you say to her, you want an iPhone? Here's how much an iPhone costs. Here's how much you make per hour for your chores. How long would it take? Boy, she can whip that word problem off in a heartbeat. You know, one of the ones we use in, in Aztec the game, Aztec the story begins, is funny because it's a similar problem to what I use with my daughter, which, well, that one is like, what fraction of the days do you do homework? But something like, how long at the rate you're doing this will it take you to get all these math problems done? Or even better, if you get, now preteens love to argue. And once they get into that early teenage, they love it even more, right? So the rate you're going, it's going to take you almost 4 hours to get those problems done. It's going to take you, no, it isn't. It's going to take you 3 hours and 40 minutes, exactly. No, it isn't. You want to know how I figured that out? Hey, I will show you. Where the thing is, you don't want to ask them, do you want to know how I figured that out? Because then it gives them the option to say no. And my children know I'm going to tell them anyway. So I try not to ask rhetorical questions. I say, I figured it out. Can you figure it out? And if your child can figure it out, you let them do it. And then they can show you. They can be smart. And you can say, well, I was wrong. I apologize. You do know. And if they don't, then you go through all those steps. And now they're invested, right? Because the minute you get them arguing with you about it, and now they want to prove their point, and so if you're going to go through and show them, well, I got it like this, you know, how, and you break it down step by step. It was, you know, it's 20 minutes, and you've done two. So how many, if you've got 24, how many you get less? Well, two. Okay, and you've been doing it 20 minutes. So how much is that per problem? Well, 10 minutes. I don't know if your kids have that attitude, but you probably had a lovelier children than I did. You know, okay, well, you've got 22 left. It's 10 minutes per problem. How many minutes is that? Well, it's 200. And, you know, and at each point, they're showing you, well, I'll show you. And again, maybe your lovely children never had an attitude, but my children are wonderful adults. But there were those, I wouldn't say years, but minutes when I just wanted to shake them. I don't know. My house, you don't have to worry about shaken baby syndrome, but it's like the shaken 12-year-old is going to get it. I did not abuse my children, okay?
I know. So many parents say, like, between 10 and 12, what am I doing wrong? Why is my child not doing this? They're normal. This is how 10 to 12-year-olds act. Whether they have any sort of special learning need, any disability, they're acting like a normal 10 to 12-year-old.
It's a really funny thing. Years ago, I was part of a study at the University of California, Riverside, where they looked at, it's a long story, but anyway, they looked at what makes somebody a good teacher, and they identified some of the best teachers in the state of California, and then they analyzed what they did. And one of the things that these teachers did, I mean, everybody does some of the time, they did almost instinctively. I was so impressed with them. That, for example, they gave a lot of prompts, so they wouldn't say, this is the answer. And they never made the kids feel stupid. They made them feel like they knew it all along. You know, like that problem, they would go through, how many problems did you do? Well, you know that. How many problems do you have left? Well, you know that. How many minutes did it take you? Well, you know that. So how much was it per problem? Okay, you know that. Well, then how much time do you have left? Well, you know that. Well, how many minutes are in an hour? Well, you know that. Well, divided by it. So the student at every point felt like they did it. And then sometimes you get to that point, they got the answer. Okay, well, maybe if I do it like this, it'll take me 3 hours and 40 minutes. And then you say, well, here's a possibility. Let's see how long you could, and make things a challenge. So this goes back to Maria's question, how do you motivate kids who aren't engaged? Let's make it a challenge. How long do you think you could do math uninterrupted without stopping? And see, and the reason that you have that kind of challenge is there is not a failure to it. You know, if the answer is 30 seconds, if the answer is 2 minutes, we, you know, I'm curious about this. Are you curious about this too? It's a question. So then you do that timer and okay, now we know 2 minutes, and whether it's 30 seconds or 5 minutes or 30 minutes, okay. So now let's do it for that length of time. And when you're done, you know, that length of time is up, let's do something else. And if it turns out to be 30 minutes, then let's take a 30-minute break. Now is when you can read your Animorphs book. Now, Animorphs probably isn't the thing now. It's probably Skullduggery Pleasant or Harry Potter or something. But when my daughter was young, that was Animorphs was the thing. You know, now you can read the book that you like. Now you can play that game you like. It's a 30-minute break. So I...
Yeah, definitely. It's you turn it back onto them to make it a challenge from their perspective. And I completely agree with the prompts that, you know, that you can pull off of those as they get the steps. But math often has a lot of steps. And memorizing the sequence of those steps is very difficult when you're first getting started. You know, it's like... My daughter always missed when you did double number multiplication that you multiply first, but when you get down to the second numbers, you add.
Which well, now that you know it is easy, right? But the first time it's difficult.
Exactly. And so we had to walk through it a lot of times. And I said, well, what's the next step? And she starts multiplying. I'm like, are you sure? You know, and turn it back and say, how is this section different from that section? You know, you just continue with the questions and that really does, it does make them feel empowered that I can figure this out. It's not like, oh, you got that wrong. Now you're stupid. We're in the learning process and how do we think through this? And we're learning how to rethink through this new step that we've now added. And
so, well, and it's them coming to the conclusion instead of you telling them. So what you just said, you have to do that a lot of times to know those steps. So instead of why do I have to do all those math problems, now you see that, yeah, you have it, but to really keep that in your brain, you need to do it a bunch of times. And now,
you know, that's another thing why it's so important to do it with your child, because if they're doing it wrong, every single one of those problems and you're not watching it, they just taught themselves the wrong thing. And that's going to even be more difficult to relearn. The initial step.
And I think if your kids do sports or maybe music, now one of my daughters was very into music, but as a general rule, no. But like one of them was really into sports, two of them, I guess. And so when I was teaching her something in judo, and if she got it right, like got it perfect, the technique perfect, I would say, okay, do that again right now, while you haven't even brain. Do it again. And so she kind of had that idea. So when we were doing math, I could say, okay, you got that right. Now do it again right now. And it sort of transferred from, you know, the sports.
Right. It goes into that longer term memory when they repeat it. Yeah. And it embeds that in what they remember on how to do it the next time. It'll stay longer than just doing it once.
The one thing that I have done, you talk about, you have to sit with them, that's a little tricky or sneaky or whatever. So some of our games, I've seen this happen because they're in libraries in some places, and one of my favorite things to do is like sit in the corner in the library, like, I don't know if you can tell from the screen, but I'm actually a pretty little person. So kind of sit in the corner and watch. I can watch kids playing games, and sometimes what will happen is they get to a part and they've tried this problem a couple of times and they've watched the hint and they've, you know, maybe done a couple of learning activities and they still don't get it. And then they call over their teacher, they call over their mom or dad, and they say, hey, what is this? I tried three different times on this problem and I still don't get it. And so then instead of you saying, sit down here, I'm going to explain how to do this problem, when they've dragged you over from whatever you're doing and insisted you sit down at the table with them and tell them how to compare fractions with different denominators, then you've got them.
Yep. So true. And it's good to have games that make kids think, because my kids, I think the one games that we failed at the most in our homeschooling was the typing ones, because my kids had that mentality, I just have to win, you know, and so they would rush through. And that, of course, is something you don't rush through is typing. but a game that's built right is going to teach those lessons, like we've been saying, and not just rush them through to get to the end to win. Right. That's not the goal. The goal is to master what the educational purpose behind it is. And just for those of you that haven't caught all of this, you know, that scope and sequence, the list of what does this game cover, that is so important, instead of just, well, this is a great math game. And so, yeah, definitely.
But, oh, my gosh. Part of my life that I will never get back. I went to something once they held here by someone who will remain nameless. So this guy was doing math. He was going to do, there's all this money in STEM. So that's kind of sets me up, right? Not on the good start. There's all this money in STEM education. So we're going to make games to teach math, to teach STEM. First of all, that's pretty darn big. That's what I said when Amy was asking me, how do you know if it's going to, we're going to teach STEM. Okay, specifically, what are you going to teach, right? So then he's going on about how they're going to do this and they have raised so much money. And I tell you what, being a grandma, I'm not the stereotype what people think are running a gaming company, right? And so, you know, so this guy goes out and gets all this money to make math games, and I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter. But anyway, so this woman sitting in the audience listening to this too says to me, excuse me, but it doesn't seem like you have any background in education at all. What makes you qualified to make games to teach math? And besides, what level of math are your games going to teach? And he says, well, it's just K through 12 math. I mean, any teacher can teach it. They'll figure out what grade level to use for. Yeah, I had that look too. And I'm sorry, wasted 2 hours of my day coming down here to listen to you, because obviously you don't know what you're doing.
Right. Unfortunately, yeah, I talked to a guy a while ago and he was telling me this great plan that he has and all this money that he's made and he's using all these buzzwords. And I said, show me what you're working on. And they could show me nothing. And yet, yeah. And I thought, oh my goodness, there's no way I'm getting behind what you're doing. There's nothing there. You're just saying what everyone wants you to hear. And that is not what's going to teach our kids and train them to do it, you know, to learn the lessons they need to learn. We need to definitely look into what the products that we use to teach our kids teach.
Well, and then the other side of that is all the people say, well, why would you make these educational games? They could just use Khan Academy. Now, there's nothing wrong with Khan Academy, but it's the idea that the same thing works for every kid. And, you know, if you have a student that you couldn't get to pay attention to the teacher when she was standing right there in front of him or her, how do you think that same kid's going to pay attention to a video of the teacher? You know, for some people, that's a great solution, but it's not the solution for everybody.
No, and especially if they can't interact, they can't stop them and ask questions when they need those questions answered, and they're unique questions. And so, yes, for a child that especially struggles and needs that interactive back and forth, that's so important to definitely know how your child best interacts with learning. And so there is no one solution that fits every child. Definitely. Well, our time is almost up. I just thank you so much. Now, for our audience, just know that Dr. Anne Maria is going to be back in 2 weeks with us. Yes. And we're going to be talking about activities and strategies for teaching gifted children, which is very exciting. So that comes on October 23rd. But next week, I'm going to be interviewing Wendy Dawson from Social Motions skills, and we're going to be talking about transition to independence. So if you have a child in high school and just what's involved with transitioning your child into adulthood, and what's the next step, whether they're still going to be living in your home or they're going to be heading off to college and maybe need some accommodations, and we're going to kind of cover all of that next week. So thank you so much for just all that you've had to share tonight. It's been so enlightening. Looks like our audience has really enjoyed it and had a lot of good questions and comments.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. And I just want to thank our audience for joining us, whether you joined us live or recorded. And I also want to thank the Learning Disabilities Foundation of America for partially funding this broadcast. You can find Dr. Ann Maria's resources at Seven Generation Games, and that's a number 7generationgames.com. And then you can also find our resources for SPED Homeschool at spedhomeschool.com. And so until next week, let's keep the conversation going. Make sure you join our support group on Facebook, where we are talking all the time about special education and homeschooling. And then we'll see you again here next week. Bye, everybody.
Thanks so much.